ambitious is to prove part of ADS-CFT for a subset of protected BPS operators and observables. So in this talk, it's just the most basic step, which is showing that BPS operators agree under the ADS-CFT correspondence. And this is based on joint work with Johannes Schmuda and Yuji Tachikawa. And the first paper is about ADS-5 duals, and the second about is our D3 brains at local Calabi-Yau singularities and matching quiver gauge theories to the dual supergravity theory. And then the second follow-up paper with Johannes is about the same program, but applying, looking at ADS-CFT where you have M2 brains probing local Calabi-Yau 4 singularities. So kind of the cartoon for ADS-CFT is we have a stack of ND3 brains at a local Calabi-Yau singularity X6, and this is going to be dual to ADS-5 times L5, where L5 is a Sasaki-Einstein manifold, and the metric cone over L5 is the local Calabi-Yau X6. And the ND3 brains dissolve into N units of flux that are on the ADS-5 and internal L5 manifold. So our goal is to match closed string states in the large N limit. And from the gauge theory, this will be achieved using something called cyclic homology, which I'll explain later, which comes fundamentally from this Q cohomology with respect to the supercharge that we use to define the index. And on the gravity theory, if you have an ordinary Freund-driven compactification, the closed strings will just come from the BPS closed strings will just come from the holomorphic data of X. But if you turn on a B field, you need to take something called Poisson homology, where pi is the bivector field describing the B field. And so this is going to be the map from the open strings in the gauge theory to closed strings in gravity. And just to get on a good footing, I want to review kind of the first matching of operators in ADS-CFT, which is for ADS-5 times S5 and N equals 4 super Yang mills. So there, N equals 4 super Yang mills has three adjoint chiral superfields, phi 1, phi 2, phi 3, and their interactions are described by the following superpotential. And if you consider an operator, which is just products of these fields, then the coefficient, the O should be T times the trace. If the coefficient is symmetric in its indices, then the operator is in a short representation of the superconformal algebra. And if it's not symmetric in indices, it'll be a descendant because the commutators will come from derivatives of the superpotential. So using the ADS-CFT dictionary, these chiral operators can be mapped to scalar excitations in ADS. And the mass of a scalar in ADS is given, it's related to the conformal dimension of a primary field in the gauge theory, or conformal field theory, just by the following relation. And here, so D is the dimension. So this will be for a D-dimensional gauge theory in ADS D plus 1. So the relationship between mass and the conformal dimension depends on explicitly on the dimension D. And then you can invert this relation. Sorry for many typos. The equals should be a plus sign. So you can solve for delta in terms of the dimension and the mass. So once you have the modes on the supergravity background, you can then extract scaling dimensions in the conformal field theory. So this is from Kim Romans von Neuwenhausen, where they explicitly worked out the spectrum of Kaluza-Klein excitations on ADS-5 times S5. And kind of this bottom spectrum with the 20, 50, and 105 is precisely the spectrum of protected operators that correspond to this trace. And starting with, say, k equals 2, you get mass squared is minus 4, which is this 20 representation. And then it corresponds to the fact that these are fields are in representations of SO6. So you're taking the nth symmetric product of SO6, which correspond to this KK mode of excitations. And so one of the first checks of ADS-CFT was actually matching all of the protected operators in the gauge theory to these conformal excitations. And what we'd like to do is kind of have a similar plot where we replace S5 by different Sasaki-Einstein manifolds and see if we can again match scaling dimensions between the gauge theory and the gravity side. So what's the main obstruction to doing this? It's that the original formulas for the KK spectrum are written in terms of things like the Laplacian of the metric. And for arbitrary Sasaki-Einstein manifold, the metrics aren't known. And in the special cases, such as the YPQ manifolds that were discovered, the Laplacian is very complicated, and solving the Laplacian reduces to solving some differential equation like the Hoyne equation. So it seems like there's a lot of very deep analytic data, but if you restrict to protected operators, the goal is to try to find something simpler than the Laplacian to deduce the KK spectrum and gravity. So instead of replacing the internal manifold, another thing you can do is change the type of compactification in ADS-CFT to something that's non-Freud and Rubin. So this corresponds to adding B-field deformation, and you'll add additional fluxes in the gravity dual. In gauge theory, there's kind of two very simple families where you either add a mass term to one of the scalars, or you just change the superpotential couplings in Yang-Mills. And these will correspond to non-Freud and Rubin compactifications. And you can ask, can we match the operators in these theories as well? So sorry, so that's the kind of end of the introduction. And since we're considering gauge theories at D3, or D3 brains at local Clebsch singularities, the corresponding world volume gauge theories are quiver gauge theories. So I just wanted to give a very quick overview of quivers, the set notation. And the idea is just the quiver is a collection of vertices and arrows between the vertices of the quiver. And the arrows are directed edges between the head and tail. The head of the arrow and tail of the arrow are just two vertices, and they're just oriented edges. And then a representation of the quiver is an assignment of a C vector space every vertex of the quiver. And you get a map between these vector spaces for every arrow in the quiver. So then from a quiver, you can construct something called a superpotential algebra, which is just the words in the quiver modulo. The idea is that the paths in the quiver are going to be representing matrices. And if you want to include the cyclicity of the trace, you need to quotient by commutators of open paths. And this will give you a space of cycles in the quiver. And then you can define a derivative acting in the space of cycles. And it's kind of defined as follows. So practically what you do is you just take whatever word in the quiver and you only differentiate the leftmost arrow, and then you sum over all cyclic permutations of the word. So given a quiver and a superpotential, which is just some cyclic word in the quiver, we can define a superpotential algebra as the Jacobian algebra, which is the quotient of the path algebra of the quiver by the Jacobian relations, or just what physicists would call F-term relations. So a general procedure for doing this was described by Aspinwall and Katz, where given a local Clebsch X, you can produce the quiver and superpotential by finding an equivalent category A, which is this quiver mod, which will be a quiver with relations given by a superpotential, and this derived equivalence. And so they have a very complicated procedure in terms of finding some exceptional collection or some tilting object actually on X and using it to construct this algebra and its A infinity structure, which is governed by the superpotential. But the main kind of property we need is just the derived category of the local Clavier will be the same as the derived category of modules over the superpotential algebra. And then kind of much more down to earth, you might be familiar with Douglas and Moore's work where they took D3 brains at an orbifold singularity and showed that for gamma, a discrete subgroup of SU2, the corresponding quiver is just the kind of a double of the ADE or affine ADE Dinkin diagram corresponding to gamma under the McKay correspondence. And then in mathematics, kind of there's a generalization of this result due to Bridgeland, King, and Reed, where they described arbitrary subgroups of SU3 in terms of quivers with potential also coming from an orbifold, basically from the representation theory of gamma. So we can physically interpret these quiver with potential as quiver gauge theories, where to each node in the quiver you assign a unitary gauge group, and then arrows are just bifundamental fields. And the superpotential will be a sum of gauge invariant operators, which in the cyclic words are naturally gauge invariant operators in the theory. So for this quiver gauge theory to flow to a superconformal fixed point, we demand that all the beta functions vanish, which implies the following two constraints. So the second one is the familiar constraint that the superpotential must be have R charge 2. But in the first equation, this is a rewriting of the one loop exact NSVZ beta function. And so it gives a very interesting constraint on the geometry. So the second part we need to transition to the superconformal index is, this is just a reminder of the superconformal algebra. So it combines both the ordinary conformal algebra, which is kind of the, you know, even spaces, with the supersymmetry algebra. And kind of the way they're arranged is the vertical dimension is how operators act on conformal dimension, and the left-right axis is for spin. And, you know, once you know these quantum numbers, it helps you kind of deduce or constrain the forms of possible commutators and anti-commutators between the generators. So the main, So this is a simple example of a superpotential algebra, which is just you take the F term relations for this non-commutative algebra, and you see that you recover the ordinary commutative algebra in three variables, which is just for n equals 4 super Yang mills. So going back to the superconformal algebra, we can then define something called a superconformal index, where we want to do something like the Witten index, and we use this charge delta, which is the anti-commutator between one of the superchargers Q and its conjugate. And then we can further refine the index by any global symmetries Mi, and we give a fugacity mu I to those global symmetries. So this is actually the non-regulated version of the index. So it'll suffer from an infinite number of ground states, but then you can find another quantum number commuting with Q to kind of break those degeneracies. So, but as in the Witten index, the ground states are the states with delta equals zero, and this is just the ordinary Hodge theory argument that representatives of cohomology can have harmonic representatives. So, right, the key anti-commutator that we need is that if just picking one of the four supercharges, that the anti-commutator of Q and its adjoint, so we pick this Q minus bar, and we get that the energy of the state minus twice its right SU2 spin minus 3/2 its R charge equals zero. And using that constraint, we just write down all the fields in the 40n equals 1 chiral multiplet and 40n equals 1 vector multiplet. And we see that these are the following letters that can contribute to the index. And we need to furthermore consider letters modulo the following equation of motion for the Gaugenos. And so what I'm interested in is at the Largent limit, we can consider a truncation of this algebra of letters to something called Ginzburg's BG algebra. And from essentially, we can just restrict attention to the chiral multiplet, because if you go back, you can see that the quantum numbers of the two Gaugenos and the derivatives exactly match. So if you take the fermionic Fock space generated by the Gaugenos and the fermionic and the bosonic Fock space generated by derivatives, they exactly cancel. So what we're left looking at, and this only works in the Largent limit, is just the letters generated by scalar phi, psi bar, and the anti-chiral multiplet, and f bar is the remaining piece from the, so this is the kind of anti-self-dual part of the curvature in the vector multiplet, and that's the only thing that remains. And I wrote down their left and right spins. And so they all have left spin 0, but we can use the right spin as the grading. And furthermore, I just wrote down their contributions to the index. So Ginzburg wrote down the free differential graded algebra that's generated by these three letters. And it has kind of many nice virtues. So in addition to the letters, he also defined a differential, which is just the supercharge Q that we use to define the index. And the action of the supercharge on the chiral, the lowest component of the chiral field is 0, because now by definition of being a chiral multiplet, it's annihilated by a particular supercharge. And then, but on the anti-chiral multiplet, acting on, so Q acting on psi bar gives you F bar. And by equations of motion, you can replace that by the partial derivative of the superpotential with respect to the corresponding bosonic field in the lowest component of the chiral multiplet. And then you can also look at Q acting on F bar. And precisely the action of the supersymmetry generators on these letters contributing to the index is what Ginzburg wrote down independently as an algebra. And furthermore, we want to consider not just the letters, but cyclic words in this algebra corresponding to gauge invariant operators. So these are just single trace operators kind of formed out of these letters. And we want to consider the operators up to taking Q cohomology. And one of the theorems proved by Ginzburg is that this is just the cyclic homology of the algebra D. And so what we're able to do is rewrite the what's called single trace index as the Euler characteristic of cyclic homology of the algebra D. And kind of in very special cases, we can relate D. So this algebra D has the virtue of being a free algebra, so it's very easy to compute the Euler characteristic of any homology. And that's actually what Ettinghoff and Ginzburg used to compute the Euler characteristic, the free DG algebra. But there's also right, so they actually had two derivations. And the second one was using a Largent matrix integral, which was reproduced by a group of physicists at Stony Brook as basically a Largent matrix integral. So how did that work? Well, what they did for quiver gauge theory is they defined something called the single letter index, which is just the contributions of all the letters, and again, these letters satisfy delta equals 0. Right, so, and right? So the single letter index you can find for chiral multiplet is this contribution from the scalar and then the fermion in the anti-chiral multiplet. And you need to sum over all the arrows in the quiver, because each arrow corresponds to bifundamental multiplet. And then you keep as a global symmetry kind of the head and the associated global symmetry for the head and the tail of the quiver. And then you'll finally integrate over the Haar measure to reduce the gauge invariant words. And the denominator comes from the two partial derivatives. So basically, you can write down phi with any number of partial derivatives, or psi bar with any number of partial derivatives. And then we just add a character corresponding to the left and right global symmetries that we'll then later gauge. And you can do the same thing by looking at the fields, basically the gauge enos in the chiral multiplet, the anti-self dual part of the curvature derivatives, and then you also need to take into account the one equation of motion for the gauge enos. So once we have all of this, we can then, you know, go from the single letters to all possible, right, so single letters are the single trace operators, to all possible multi-trace operators by taking what's called statistic exponential and then integrating over the Haar measure to project back down onto gauge singlets. And so in the large n limit, this is computed using methods of Kinney et al. By the Sonnenberg group. And they found that you can write it as an infinite product in terms of the determinant of one minus single letter index. And then from the full superconformal index, once you do this projection onto gauge invariant operators, you can then go back and extract the single trace index, which is just the inverse of the plethysmic exponential, so it's called plethysmic log. And it has kind of the following explicit expression where mu n is the Mobius function and phi is the Euler phi function. And what's amazing is you're taking, you know, logs of determinants and summing them with these number theoretic functions. But at the end of the day, you get very simple rational functions for, you know, quiver gauge theories that have ADS-CFT duals. So even, I think from the point of view of their paper, that's somewhat remarkable. But the advantage of reformulating, instead of doing the large n-matrix integral, you can reformulate everything in terms of cyclic homology. And the cyclic homology also has the same expression as the matrix integral, but you can directly compute the single trace index, or single trace states that contribute to the index by taking Q-bar cohomology. And then you don't have to do this kind of procedure. So, you know, the idea was you take letters, and then you form, you know, all possible words. Right. So this is going to be like sort of one particle, but not gauge invariant. And then you form, so this is like taking a Fock space. And then you project the gauge invariants by integrating over the Haar measure. And then you need to, you know, come back by doing the, or, well, so you don't come back to here, but so this is all letters, but then when you come back, you get basically the gauge invariant single trace operators. And basically the index over the gauge invariant, you can extract the index over the gauge invariant single trace operators by this kind of roundabout procedure, or you could just directly compute the Q-bar cohomology. And so that's the formulation that we found advantageous for matching between gauge theory and gravity. And the point of doing this is that you have something called Poisson-Constant-Rosenberg isomorphism, which lets you take the cyclic cohomology of the algebra and express it in terms of ordinary Durham or Hodge. Well, things like the ordinary Hodge groups of the local Clavius X. And since you know that the algebra and X have equivalent derived categories, and cyclic cohomology is an invariant of derived categories, you can pass from the open string sector to the closed string sector. And this allows us to rewrite the single trace index directly in terms of the geometry of the local Clavius X. So finally, once you have an expression in terms of Durham cohomology groups of X, you can relate them to the spectrum of operators on the Sasaki-Einstein manifold L5, which is the base of the cone of X. So X is the cone over the Sasaki-Einstein manifold. And if you take these Hodge, elements of the cohomology of X, they'll reduce to certain eigenfunctions of the Laplacian on the base L. And the most famous example of this is if you take any holomorphic function on X, it'll reduce to an eigenfunction of the Laplacian on the base. So this is actually kind of a cute trick for doing spherical harmonics on S5. You just write down, polynomials on C3, and then they restrict to eigenfunctions of the Laplacian. And kind of because of certain mixing in supergravity, you don't get the Laplacian on the nose, but you'll get different linear combinations of so delta 0 is the eigenfunction of scalar Laplacian, delta 1 is the eigenfunction of Laplacian on one forms. And so you can get various kind of expressions in terms of the square root of the Laplacian and different shifts. And all of this geometric data needs to assemble into both short and long representations of this superconformal algebra. And from the point of view of differential geometry, it seems, I think it's still a little miraculous that this happens. I don't think there's actually a theorem in mathematics saying that these spectrums of differential operators on manifolds have to assemble into certain representations of the superconformal group. And in fact, you get, there are some theorems about relating spectrum of operators on manifolds, and in very simple cases, reproduce them. And in fact, you can translate certain bounds on spectrum of operators, like spectrum of the Dirac operator on Einstein manifolds, to certain things about the representation theory of the supersymmetry algebra. But kind of, there's a little overlap from the mathematics literature, but kind of, a lot of the techniques, especially for understanding the Lisch-Nerfix operator, just aren't currently available in mathematics. So, but what we're able to do is just look at, essentially what we wanted to do is bound the spectrum of these operators by translating the R charge into supergravity, which is just the action of the Lie derivative along one of the modes. And so if you, of course, the idea is that, you want to prove not just the bound on spectrum of the Laplacian, but spectrum of the Laplacian given that the function is also an eigenfunction of Lie derivative along the Riebe vector with respect with a particular eigenvalue. You want to bound the spectrum of the Laplacian in terms of that eigenvalue. And what we were able to do is kind of match the operators that saturate that bound precisely with the with the cohomology groups of the local club Yao. And that's, you know, how you can go from cohomology groups of the local club Yao to actual kind of honest KK spectrum on the base of the club Yao cone. Okay, so yeah, I wanted to kind of give a few examples of this and then move from Freund-Rubin compactifications to more general string theory compactifications. So here, I just wrote down kind of the recurring example of n=4 supreme nulls and its superpotential algebra. And you can just directly compute from the definition of the Ginzburg-DG algebra the cohomology groups just by looking at Q closed mod Q exact. And you know, these are the HC0 groups are precisely the symmetric powers of SU3, because instead of looking at symmetric powers of SS6, which is with respect to the full R symmetry group of n=4, I'm restricting to an n=1 subgroup of the full group. Basically, I'm just looking at the n=1 superconformal subalgebra of n=4. And then these elements of HC1, you can actually see that, you know, the higher cohomology group that's eight-dimensional corresponds to the fact that there's an SU3 global symmetry of n=4 superyang mills. That's just rotation of the three chiral multiplets. And the second cohomology group, again, will be the Klutze-Klein, will correspond to the Klutze-Klein excitations of the graviton. And you know, so you have these very complicated cyclic cohomology groups about symmetric powers of the fundamental representation of SU3, and then actually HC1 are kind of these interesting, you know, L-shaped Young tableau. But at the end of the day, when you compute the index, they have a very strong calculation in that it's just constant in each degree. So, you know, this is sort of some hint of a localization for the index, that, you know, the details are very complicated, but you just get a very simple answer at the end of the day. So you can ask, in the beta deformation where we just change the superpotential coefficients, what happens to the cyclic homology groups and what happens to the BPS space of states? And this is actually, you know, a not so easy calculation in mathematics, but the zeroth cohomology group is a very simple interpretation that was worked out by Bernstein, Jayla, and Lai. And the idea is you just look at some word made out of letters in the theory, and we're just restricting to the scalars since we want it to be spin zero. And by cyclicity of the trace, I can take one of the operators and move it all the way around. And each time I exchange it, I pick up something that's Q exact, but I also change the coefficient by Q to this difference of the number of Z fields and Y fields. So if the number of Z fields and Y fields is different, then this operator has to be zero in Q cohomology. So, you know, using this constraint, you can show that number of Z fields needs to be equal to the number of Y fields, and number of Y fields needs to equal the number of X fields. So basically, you can either get operators with the same number of X, Y, and Z fields, or the other way to satisfy it is just to have all X fields, all Y fields, or all Z fields. And this kind of, if you're careful, you see that this argument critically depends on the fact that Q is not a root of unity. And if Q is an nth root of unity, the cyclic homology groups will actually jump and get corrections whenever you have, you know, so you could, whenever the number of, say, Z fields minus Y fields are, you know, twice this difference is N, then you would get Q to the N equals 1, so you'd have no contradiction. So you'd have additional operators that are in cyclic homology if Q is a root of unity. But in the generic case, you can just write down the cyclic homology groups. And the amazing thing is these first cyclic homology groups were found kind of by, you know, some, you know, 20 or 30 pages of calculations of Feynman diagrams where they just write down all possible words, and then they compute their anomalous dimensions and find, kind of diagonalize and find the number of operators of each dimension that get no vanishing, or that have vanishing correction to their conformal dimension. So this argument by Bernstein and Lay lets you reproduce this kind of 20 or 30 pages of calculations of Feynman diagrams just to a simple algebraic argument. And if you go to compute higher cyclic homology groups, you get a prediction for the operators that have zero anomalous dimension, that have, you know, SET left spin zero and SET right spin one half, or the SET spin one operators as well. And again, so the spectrum of operators actually looks very different from the spectrum of operators in n equals 4 Chebyshev mills. In particular, this pattern of the dimension of operators at each level, you know, is no longer polynomial increasing, it's just constant at each level. But when you look at the cancellations in the index, you see that you get the exact same result, and it's because the beta deformation is an exactly marginal deformation of n equals 4 Chebyshev mills. So what happens is, under exactly marginal deformations, two short multiplets can combine and form a long multiplet, and then that long multiplet can acquire an anomalous dimension, but the index is constructed that to be kind of capture all information that's protected under the process of two short representations of the superconformal algebra forming a long representation. So this is entirely consistent with that. And another example is if you give a mass to one of the fields of n equals 4, physically you can just integrate that out and you get a superpotential which is quartic in x and y. So you can either work with this quartic algebra or with the original algebra with the mass. And the mass gives you kind of a commutator between x and y. So again, it'll change the spectrum of fields because now we have more things to quotient by. So if you compute the cyclic homology group, So now we see that the index is no longer the same as for n equals 4 Chebyshev mills. And the reason is that this wasn't an exactly marginal deformation. It was a relevant deformation that takes you to a new conformal fixed point instead of somewhere else in the same moduli space of conformal field theories. And kind of the next, what I want to show is that if you do Kaluza-Klein, so this theory with this super simple mass deformation has a known ADS-CFT dual description, and it was discovered by Pilch and Warner. And we can actually match the second cyclic homology group to the KK modes of the graviton in that solution. And of course, kind of the nicest thing would be to extend this to the, you know, matching of all modes. But for scalars and vectors, you get additional mixing that just requires some extra work to perform the full matching. So just to give you an idea of what's involved, instead of being Freund-Rubin, where this warp factor is independent of kind of the internal geometry, now the warp factor delta it goes like this omega minus 2, which explicitly depends on one of the angles, chi of kind of the squashed S5. And C is supposed to be kind of play the role of the radius of the squashed sphere. So in Freund-Rubin, it's completely independent of the angle. And when you look at the spectrum of the Laplacian, you know, before this, since there's no angular dependence of delta, you could just reduce to the ordinary Laplacian on the internal manifold, but now we have something that's kind of like a warped Laplacian, but you can still find this spectrum of this differential operator for the background I gave, and it exactly matches with, so, you know, it gives you eigenvalues for a spectrum of gravitons, and sorry, if you go maybe all the way back to this table, you'll see kind of the philosophy is actually that the spectrum of the graviton on ADS5 is in some sense the simplest mode because it's exactly, its mass is exactly given by eigenvalues of the Laplacian. And kind of these square roots come from some mixing between fields. So it's, that's why it's easiest just to focus on the KK modes of the graviton. And so, right, in the Pilcher-Werner background, instead of taking the eigenvalue of the Laplacian, you take the eigenspectrum of this warped Laplacian, and you see which of these modes satisfy the BPS bound to give you, to fit into short representations of the graviton multiplet. And it exactly matches the second cyclic cohomology groups. So another nice algebra use of cyclic cohomology is you can show that if your algebra is something called Calabi-Yau 3, which is kind of a duality, it's the analog of Sayre duality for the Calabi-Yau, but in terms of the quiver. And if your algebra is Calabi-Yau 3, then you can show that all the higher cyclic cohomology groups vanish. And this is good because we identified the zeroth, first, and second cyclic cohomology groups with the protected or short multiplets in gravity. And there shouldn't, and you know, since there are no fields of spin higher than 2 in supergravity, once you kind of do the precise matching, you would see that having higher cyclic homology groups would correspond to having spins of, or multiplets that have, you know, highest element with spin greater than 2 in gravity. And so for ordinary ADS-50, that's not, you know, we expect it just to be a theory of gravity and not a theory of higher spins. So the other nice property is that the second cyclic cohomology group is just the is known to be the center of the algebra. And the kind of one of the older ideas in physics is that the center of the superpotential algebra should tell you about the geometry of the space. And now we have another interpretation in terms of just the KK modes of the graviton. So what have we done? We've shown how to compare the protected fields on both sides of the ADS-CFT correspondence. And this is at large n. And so it's kind of very natural to try to see if we can extend this to finite n. But the cyclic cohomology groups become much harder to compute because there's no longer this cancellation between partial derivatives and Gaugino's. And for further directions, you'd like to use not just truncation of the Ginzburg DG algebra, but kind of all fields that contribute to the superconformal index. And this has kind of close relations to a program of Costello of proving ADS-CFT under a holomorphic twist. And of course, you can look at other twists and other compactifications. So far with Johannes, we looked at M-theory compactifications that are Freund-Rubin type, but you can also look at non-Freund-Rubin M-theory compactifications, and especially you know, the corresponding Lunin-Meldacena compactification that corresponds to the beta deformation, and compared the predictions we had for protected operators in that theory. And finally, there are supergravity solutions of Meldacena and Giotto that describe the class TN theories. And you could try to apply similar ideas with the cyclic cohomology to try to match protected operators in not just ordinary gauge theories, but maybe the larger limits of TN theories. So thank you.
Something about M-cobrain CFTs.
Let's see. I gave a talk on that at PS. So maybe. I won't repeat the talk, but maybe. One of the examples I had is something called Q111. So there it's described by a curvature and Simons theory. Let me make this full screen. And kind of you can, if you have a empty brains at a torque labial, you can describe everything in kind of combinatorially. So the idea is that the states contributing to the index are going to be colored in blue and green, where these are, so this is just a way of computing, you know, so what I did earlier is I showed for Calabi-Yau 3 compactifications how to write everything in terms of sums of cyclic, or sums of just cohomology groups of X. And what Johannes and I found is that for empty brains at Calabi-Yau 4 singularities, you can also write things in terms of cohomology groups of the local Calabi-Yau X. And there's actually a very fun combinatorial way to do this. And the reason I liked Q111 is that there was a paper by a Kies group where they computed the superconformal index on Q111. And they also tried to compute using old supergravity results, the index and match. But in fact, their calculations disagreed. And they had a way to fix the calculation if they threw out what they thought were extraneous KK towers, but they had no justification for this. But kind of using the same techniques we had, you can go back and compare with what they computed on the gauge theory side, and it exactly matches without, you know, adding extra multiplets or throwing any away. So it gives us, so for Q111, we have an exact, now we have an exact equivalence between the index on gauge theory and gravity, and then you could try to extend this not just to Q111, but any arbitrary torque, Calabi-Yau fourfold. But unlike D3 brains at a Calabi-Yau 3 singularity, there's no generic procedure for how to write down the corresponding curvature and Simons theory. So, you know, there are many different procedures, and then not all of them are equivalent. And so hopefully you can compute the index for all of these theories and then see which ones actually match to gravity. And that could give some kind of hints for the right way forward to find the corresponding M theory duals. Sorry? Yes, so these are basically. Baryons or mesons? Right, so this is actually, so the zeroth cohomology is just the mesons. Oh, okay. Yes, this is very interesting. Right, so you could add like one probe D7 brain. Right, so there I think there should be something like an extension of the Ginzburg-DG algebra where you have, you know, not just by fundamentals, but you would have strings that just end, you just have a global flavor symmetry group for the D7 brains. Yeah. So I think in the large end limit, you should be able to match. But you would need some kind of extension. I mean, Q-bar cohomology will still work, but it's just a matter of computing these and trying to see if it has some nice properties. Yeah, and I should say that kind of the answer we have basically always localizes to either the edges or the vertices of these cones of holomorphic functions. And so the geometric answer we get by brute force looks like something that should come from localization, which is another interesting direction to try to re-derive using kind of these new techniques developed by localization and supergravity. If you can reproduce the gravity result for ADS4 or ADS5 compactifications.